everyone, and welcome to the court. We have one case today, United States v. Nadal M. Hassan. The panel raises a number of legal issues before this court. However, the parties have agreed that oral argument on four of those issues will be of particular assistance to this court in terms of deciding this case. Therefore, this morning's oral argument will be broken into two segments. In segment one, we will hear oral argument on issues 5 and 10. The court will then recess for 20 minutes. In segment two, we will hear oral argument on issues 2 and 3. Regardless of the running of the clock, I assure counsel for both parties that you will be given a full and fair opportunity to answer all questions from the bench. Therefore, let's proceed. Major Osterhage, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant? And Major Sunduk, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Brian Osterhage, and along with Mr. Jonathan Potter and Captain Carol Rim, we represent the appellant. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Death is different from all other punishment, and there is a corresponding need in the reliability in its determination. To this end, the Supreme Court has consistently required that capital cases be policed at all stages with extreme care for procedural safeguards, and has taken special care to minimize the possibility that any death sentence is imposed on the basis of mistake or prejudice. Given this heightened scrutiny, the issues presented in appellant's brief and here today show why this court cannot affirm the Army Court's decision. Now, I will be arguing the Army Court's disqualification and the right or the infringement of appellant's ability to plead guilty. Mr. Potter will be arguing how the court denied appellant's right to trial and his right to a fair panel. Turning to the Army Court's disqualification, RCM 902 and the Code of Judicial Conduct make clear a judge shall disqualify themselves whenever a reasonable person might question their impartiality. Here, that test has been met for three reasons. First, every appellate judge of the Army Court was in the remarkable position of having to take action on whether or not their raider, General Risch, committed error in this case as the staff judge advocate. Two, the error was significant and occurred in the most high-profile case in recent military memory. And three, there was a complete lack of transparency. There was no disclosure, there was no disclaimer, and this court should afford little deference. Now, I want to address out front the removal of General Risch from the rating chain right before the court's decision and how it has no impact on the relief we're seeking here today. So this case was docketed in 2017 at the Army Court. In 2018, General Risch was the rater of the appellate judges. He rated and senior rated every appellate judge with the exception of the chief judge, who he rated. And the conflict, that is General Risch's rating of the court, he was not removed until 2020, right before the opinion. So we have this great length of time, and in that time, we have 150 pleadings. We have numerous orders and rulings that directly impact our rights and abilities before the court, that it included motions for appellate discovery, resources, including those resources aimed at helping us perfect our case against General Risch, or perfecting that error, I should say. At that point, I think the law is clear. When that conflict was removed, it does nothing to retroactively cure any decision up until that point. And our position is there was a continuing duty to recuse after that point. That is to say that once You are disqualified and continue to make decisions on the case. You cannot become requalified. Regardless of that, however, the most important thing is to look at the circumstances surrounding General Risch's removal. How it occurred, the last word from the Army Court on the recusal was that they were going to decide, or excuse me, reveal their basis on recusal in the opinion. And that was in September 9th of 2020. And they dropped a footnote saying that that argument was not going to be presented at oral argument. And to us, that was telegraphing that they had decided the issue on the merits already. They knew how they were going to dispose of this case. And that was before General Risch was ever removed. He was removed a week later. And when you look at that opinion, and in fact it says nothing about the recusal or the basis of the recusal, and ostensibly we were correct in deciding at that point our concern, which was they were telegraphing that they had already made up their minds prior to General Risch's removal. So our position is that removal has no effect on the recusal error or the remedy under Liljeburg. So I want to turn now to the remedy.
Before you do that, I'm asked, how important is that last point to your argument that we should presume that they had already made up their minds before the recusal? Does your argument turn on that particular fact?
It does not, Your Honor, for the simple fact that even if the conflict did remove or did cure prospectively, it cannot cure retrospectively. So we still have all of those rulings, all of those decisions leading up to that point. That is something that removal cannot change. We're aware of no authority for that position that it would be able to cure all of those rulings up until that point.
Counsel, following up on that, good morning. Following up on that, as you spoke about the rulings on the motions and the pleadings, three of those issues or motions were directly related to then-Major General Risch. But what about, so I can clearly see in your argument the concern about those rulings, but is it your position that every issue in front of the CCA at that point because of the conflict is tainted?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. And I would make three notes, and this is something that actually when we look at the risk of injustice under Liljeburg, this is important, but our position is once the recusal or the requirement for recusal was triggered, everything that they've touched is now infected. It's not just those relating to General Risch, it's all of their decisions. 902 specifically says a judge is disqualified from the proceeding, not from the issue. And this court in McIlwain has made clear that once a judge should recuse, anything that she acts on after that point that requires discretion is discretion that she does not have. And when you look at Liljeburg, there was nothing about the specific of individual rulings. They looked at the case as a whole. So, yes, Your Honor, our position is every ruling, not just those relating to General Risch. So in turning to Liljeburg, there are three prongs, the risk of injustice to the parties, the risk of injustice to future litigants, and the risk of undermining public confidence. Now, going to the first prong, the risk of injustice, Your Honor, which we were touching on just earlier, our position, again, is we're looking at the whole of the rulings. And if we're looking for harm, then there was, in fact, harm. And I would note that one of those rulings, or actually several of those rulings, were rulings prohibiting us from reviewing the record. So we were not able to see, in a capital case, the entire record. And once this court allowed us to see the record, it changed everything. It changed what issues we were going to decide to bring forth to this court. It changed our relationship with our client, which was our concern that we were talking about to the Army Court. And now we're looking at having issues that we never had a chance to raise before the Army Court. Not only did they not have a chance to hear our issues, but we were deprived of the should-be-approved powers of the CCA in raising those issues. So certainly when we're looking at risk of injustice, it is there. And balancing that out with the risk of injustice to the government, the cost of a remand are slight. Now, I want to talk briefly then about the last prong, the undermining public confidence. So really there are four points that I want to make. Two of them come from this court's decision in Martinez. So when we're looking at public confidence, Martinez asked first, was there an adequate, was there relief that was provided? Right? When we look at the opinion, right, we see no relief of any kind. In fact, they don't even mention an error of any kind. Right? So unlike Martinez and the cases like Uribe, there is no relief that was given by the Army Court. Second, Martinez would ask, was an appearance ever explained? Right? The Army Court, even upon request, refused to say why it believed it could continue. And after saying that it would reveal the basis, did not do so. So we believe that is going, again, to the public confidence prong. You have the third prong, a third reason, which is the scope of this court's review is much more limited than at the Army Court. There is should be approved. This is a capital case, and we are not raising the issues that we should be raising to the Army Court. And that, again, goes to the public confidence. And lastly, the fact that we were ever in the position of having to ask TJAG to remove General Risch, that it was on the defense at that point to do that, when it's clearly the judge's responsibility. If there is an ability to cure the conflict, it is the judge's responsibility. The fact that it was on us at that point to do something, I think also greatly erodes public confidence. So there's error. General Risch's removal had no impact, and analysis under Lilleberg would certainly indicate that this case should be remanded for a full review under 66.
Counsel, with such a remand, what would the order say? Would we take it, since we had all those preliminary rulings on discovery and everything else, where would we restart on the remand? Just from the very beginning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And Counsel, I just want to be clear. This entire argument is predicated on the fact that when the CCA judges originally declined to recuse themselves, that was an abuse of their discretion. The error that you're referring to that tainted everything else that happened, that's the error, right? We have to agree with you that the CCA judges abused their discretion in declining to recuse themselves for all of the rest of the consequences to occur, right?
So I think once there was an abuse of discretion, and again, I think the latest point that comes is in August of 2018 when they've denied the order. Yes, then everything after that is a continuing violation of 902, Your Honor. Everything that they're touching, all the substantive rulings, right, have to come under scrutiny now by this court. Now, I'd like to turn, unless there are any other questions on...
Yes, Major. Can you explain to me again why, even though you may not have been able to argue certain issues before the CCA, that those issues are now here and can be argued? You mentioned that the problem or prejudice from your standpoint is the fact that our court has a more limited jurisdiction. But is that, can you flesh that out just a little more? I know we have, obviously we don't have factual sufficiency review, but other than that, don't we still have the same jurisdiction over matters of law, which many of your assigned errors are?
Yes, Your Honor, but this court lacks the should be approved authority that is the CCAs have. That the CCAs are the proverbial 800-pound gorilla. So
Judge Cox would be proud of you for that.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think there's a problem there, and to maybe put a more finer point, it's the risk is, even without that, should be approved. The risk of injustice when we're looking at it really should be when we're looking at the decisions of the CCA It's not whether or not those were necessarily how this court would decide them, but could it have gone another way? And if this court thinks, yes, it could have gone another way, reasonable minds can differ, then there was, in fact, a risk of injustice. I think if you look back at Lilleberg, that's how it would be looking at the risk of injustice. And I think we've supplementally cited Orr for that proposition, that the risk of injustice is really coming from whether or not there was discretion that was utilized that would otherwise, in fact, be discretion. So I think if there's a distinction between saying no judge would have ever allowed that versus yes, reasonable minds can differ. So it's not so much that whether or not or how this court decides the issues, it's whether a different outcome could have been in theory possible at the lower court.
So could you flesh that out a little bit more? You were just saying it could have gone the other way. What are you referring to? The ultimate decision or decision on discrete issues? What are you referring to?
I'm referring to all of the rulings and the decisions, Your Honor. So if we're looking at that, we're saying, what is the risk? The risk would be, again, looking at everything from the time of recusal forward, right? If there was discretion that was being utilized for those rulings, which there were, and it would not have been an abuse of discretion to go the other way, then I think the risk of injustice is there. Again, the Orr case that we've supplementally cited clearly is for that proposition. I'd like to turn to the denial of appellant's guilty plea. This court's decision in Dock, which held that Article 45's prohibition receiving guilty pleas to capital offenses is determined by the four corners of the record, was wrong for three reasons. First, the plain meaning of the term guilty plea. As we look to the first to the plain meaning. A guilty plea means one thing, a plea that itself can result in conviction. Second, when we look to the tools of statutory construction to ensure that that is, in fact, the right answer, the legislative history, the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, all suggest that that is, in fact, the correct interpretation. Guilty plea means one thing, a plea that can result in a conviction. And then third, point this court to the Supreme Court's decision in Jackson, cited in the brief, but in the fourth error, discussing or endorsing a view of a lower court that, given such the rampant use of pleas and how necessary they are to our system, that for Congress to remove that authority, we should be looking for unambiguous expression from Congress that that was what they meant. So when we look at 45's prohibition, guilty plea, not being able to plead guilty to a capital offense means one thing only, that plea itself leads to the capital offense, leads to the conviction. So appellant's pleas to unpremeditated murder, which were not capital offenses, attempted premeditated murder, which were not capital offenses, and attempted unpremeditated murder, which were not capital offenses, were not prohibited by Article 45B. And it was error to deny appellant wholesale that right to plead guilty. And there was prejudice. First, I would point this court to the decision in Trujillo, cited in our brief, that post-McCoy, where a court strips a defendant of the right to plead guilty, such an error would be so impermissibly infringed upon the defendant's protected autonomy as to be structural error. So our position is this error was, in fact, structural. But even if not, harmless beyond reasonable doubt is what should apply, and the government is unable to meet its burden. We are not able to determine what effect his pleas would have on the sentence. And lastly, even if this court disagrees as to those, clearly the Army Court refused to entertain this issue and perhaps even couldn't entertain this issue because Doc was controlling precedent on them. At the very least, this issue calls for a remand for the CCA to determine what is the prejudice and should it exercise its should-be-approved powers. You have, in a capital case, an appellant who says, I want to plead guilty, We said you can't do that, and you better not even concede your guilt. That is what Doc had over this capital trial. He could not stipulate. He could not concede, even if he wasn't even pleading guilty. And that, we are saying, is structural error.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Is it your view that regarding the doctrine of stare decisis, that all of the requirements or elements, so to speak, of a stare decisis analysis must be met, or can you just pick one? In this case, you're kind of focusing on just one of those elements. In other words, Doc was wrongly decided. But there are other elements in the decision in a stare decision analysis before a court decides to get rid of or overturn a longstanding precedent.
Yes, Your Honor. So there are four considerations this court has identified, whether or not it's poorly reasoned and unworkable, any intervening events, the expectations of service members, and the risk of undermining public confidence. Your Honor, to answer your question, I don't think you necessarily need all of those, but it's just the factors by which guide this court to decide whether or not it's going to overturn and not abide by the doctrine of stare decisis. However, I would say we're not just focusing on that first prong.
I understand, yeah.
There are intervening events, so that's McCoy. Certainly can be viewed as an intervening event, which is the right, a Sixth Amendment autonomy right to concede guilt that the Supreme Court recognized in McCoy v. Louisiana in 2018. I also think there's a risk.
Now, wait a minute, though. In that case, wasn't the Supreme Court saying that the defendant had the ability, the autonomy, the right to be able to assert innocence rather than assert guilt?
That was that case, Your Honor. However, I don't think the opinion was written so narrowly, Your Honor. It indicated that whether to admit guilt and ask for mercy or assert your innocence is the fundamental objectives that are guaranteed by that right of autonomy. So it wasn't just maintaining.
So you view the right of autonomy as being a much broader concept than the way the Supreme Court defined it, and it's not really tethered to the facts of that case?
That is correct, Your Honor. I certainly think, again, looking at what the opinion said, it wasn't just limited to maintaining innocence. It clearly indicated maintain innocence or admit guilt and ask for mercy. That was the flip side of that statement in McCoy. So clearly it seems like you should have, if you're going to have one, right, the other one is necessarily correlated with that. I mean, you should have your right in a capital trial to tell your story. And if that story is, I was guilty, then that's what it should be.
So the military judge offered to appellant the ability to have her instruct the panel members that he sought to plead guilty, but was prevented from doing so under operation of law. Would that have cured the problem here?
No, Your Honor. I think there is, the first consideration is how does the plea affect what evidence comes in? So regardless of what appellant is saying, for the sentencing instructions, you still have the question of what impact would a guilty plea have on what evidence is coming in and what evidence is being decided by the fact finder, that delicate weighing of balance between aggravating and mitigating circumstances. So regardless of what appellant says at that point, you still have that issue to deal with. And that is the problem that the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what harm would that have been, or that would be harmless, rather, that it would be the same result regardless of his pleas. And that is independent of what he says regarding the mitigation value of that guilty plea.
So you know you're using the harmlessness standard. Are you giving up on the structural error issue?
No, Your Honor. I think our position is threefold. I think we would first be looking to structural error.
Well, under Greer, the Supreme Court just recently said, for structural error, really looking at a situation where the criminal trial is fundamentally unfair. How was this unfundamentally unfair here? What would you point to?
So I would point to the fact that he was unable to tell his story his way. I mean, what we're looking at is the interests that are protected by Feretta and McCoy, that autonomy right, that right to tell your story your way. In fact, it is your life, your liberty at stake. So those are the interests at play, and I believe Greer was a rehafe issue where the judge failed to instruct on an element of the offense rather than deny wholesale the ability to plead guilty. In fact, I think Trujillo was responding to the Greer-Gary decision saying that would not be structural error, but we can imagine a situation in which you would have the wholesale denial of a guilty plea, such as in this instance, be structural error.
Counsel, how do we square your argument that this structural error denied the appellant the ability to present the case the way he wanted to present it with the fact that he declined the proposed jury instruction and then he also put on no sentencing case?
So, Your Honor, what I would say is guilty plea is more than just mitigation. Guilty plea also has other interests at stake in how he tells his story. So just the fact that he or an accused may perceive a guilty plea as more than just mitigating. I mean, the fact that he didn't want that instruction, there are other interests at stake as opposed, or in addition to that, just is the guilty plea is more than just mitigation. That's what I would say.
But can you give us something concrete rather than just theoretical concepts here? How was he prejudiced in this instance? How was his trial rendered fundamentally unfair?
Your Honor, DOC stands for the proposition that not only can you plead guilty, you cannot stipulate to your guilt, which appellant wanted to do during trial, even after they go into the contest. He's willing at that point to stipulate to almost everything. And the government says, we can't do this out of the gate because of 45. Right? So if we're looking at concrete examples, right, I would say there is at least one point, if not more, in the trial where he is attempting to stipulate. I understand that there's no right to stipulate, but he's denied the opportunity to stipulate because of Doc's interpretation on 45. Then that is a concrete example of how there would be fundamental unfairness.
Well, you seem to be articulating the inability to plead, but how did that have a negative effect either on a finding of guilty by the panel members or the punishment that was imposed? That's what I'm trying to get to.
Your Honor, structural error protects other interests, not necessarily that go to the reliability of the ultimate issue of guilt or innocence or the sentence. Public trial is a great example of a structural error that does not go to the guilt or innocence or the punishment. There are other interests at stake. It's going to be hard to capture those interests, and we recognize how important those values are, and we're going to protect those values. And that is what structural error is getting at.
Can I go back to an issue touched upon by Judge Hardy? And that is what I thought you said earlier, and please correct me if I misunderstood you. But I remember you said something that having been denied the opportunity to plead guilty, the appellant in this case, it somehow affected or would have affected the evidence that comes in. Were you talking about evidence that he would present or the government would present? And assuming the government would have proceeded on the greater offenses, how would that have been affected? Is it kind of the example you just gave with regard to the opportunity to stipulate? Is it that kind of thing, or was?
Well, that could be part of it, Your Honor. I think the defense counsel points out specifically autopsy reports, bullet fragments, trajectory analysis that potentially could be coming out. And I think part of the problem is it's very hard at this point, 2020 hindsight, looking back to say what exactly would have come in, what would have not come in. And in fact, I think we cite Clemens for the position that it should be HBRD as the standard, but Clemens goes a little bit further and says, however, when the prejudice is speculative or impossible, like this court should not even try to do HBRD. In fact, I believe this Court has cited Clemens for that proposition in one of the cases for Loving v. Hart, Your Honor, for that proposition. So I think at the end of the day, if it's going to be, hey, this is a really difficult call for us to make, then this Court should not even be trying to do the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis.
Counsel, you've articulated your reasons why you think DOC is impermissibly broader than Article 45. If we disagree with you that DOC is not, that we decline to overturn DOC, do you have any argument that this case is distinguishable from DOC? Or do you believe that if DOC is good law, then it would apply to the circumstances here?
So, Your Honor, we did argue at the Army Court below, and we did mention it in our reply brief to this Court, that at least with Option 3, which is unpremeditated across the board, there could be a way to, in fact, distinguish DOC, but most likely only with Option 3. Option 2 was unpremeditated murder and attempted premeditated murder. I think DOC is going to squarely probably control that option, but certainly Option 3, unpremeditated murder across the board, there could be a way to distinguish DOC. However, I think, for the reasons we discussed, and I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Please continue your thought.
For the reasons discussed and the other ways DOC implicated or hindered in the trial the ability to stipulate, concede guilt at all, I think the better approach is to say this Court needs to overrule DOC.
More questions from the bench.
Can I ask one question?
Absolutely.
I didn't want to take up your time with respect to Issues 5 and 10, but can you clarify the defense position on the issues that are listed in Section 4 of the brief and the structural issues where we have the issue but no argument? I mean, usually when we have a brief, we have an issue and an argument. I'm unfamiliar with that, and I'm just trying to understand what the defense position is in listing the issue without argument.
Your Honor, I think our position was in order to preserve the issues for any future appeal.
And we're to rule on the merits on all those issues?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And are we to rule on the merits of all those issues?
Certainly, Your Honor, that would be your prerogative, yes.
More questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Sunder.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Major Jennifer Sunduk, and with my co-counsel, Captain Tim Emmons, we represent the United States. I'd like to begin with the 45 Bravo issue, unless the court would prefer I begin with the issue involving General Risch.
Please present it any way you'd like.
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge did not abuse her discretion when she rejected appellant's pleas of guilty because in the context of this case, his pleas would have acknowledged premeditation in violation of Article 45 Bravo's prohibition of guilty pleas to capital offenses. Article 45 Bravo prohibits not just the formal entry of pleas to capital offenses, but also de facto guilty pleas to capital offenses. This is true based on the plain meaning of the statute, clear legislative intent, and 65 years of precedent. Appellant has failed to carry his substantial burden to justify overturning precedent and departing from stare decisis. Even if this court did choose to overturn 65 years of precedent, appellant merits no relief because he rejected the military judge's offer of a mitigation instruction in sentencing. Thus, there has been no prejudice. Beginning first with the plain meaning of a plea of guilty in Article 45 Bravo, Black's Law Dictionary defines a plea of guilty as a confession of guilt in open court. Therefore, a plea of guilty is more than just the formal entry of pleas. It also includes de facto guilty pleas. By entering a plea of guilty to unpremeditated murder, The appellant would have confessed to guilt in open court to premeditation based on the facts and the context of this case. To quote the military judge, and this is on JA 282, the difference between the intent to kill in unpremeditated murder and the premeditated design to kill is very slight. You couple that with a number of acts that form the basis of the attempted murders and the murders that happened in sequence, and the four corners of the record will be that the accused is functionally admitting to a capital offense in violation of Article 45. Therefore, the plain meaning of Article 45 Bravo prohibits the pleas that appellant wished to enter, and the military judge did not abuse her discretion in rejecting appellant's pleas and appropriately applying Dock to the facts of this case. Appellant argues that a plea of guilty is amounts to a conviction or has finality. That's not correct, though, because a plea of guilty does not automatically result in conviction under our system. There has to be the providence inquiry. The case law that appellant references for the idea that a plea of guilty is a conviction or has finality is analogizing the effects of a plea of guilty to resulting in conviction. And likewise, a de facto plea of guilty would result in a conviction, just as the formal entry of pleas. If this court disagrees and finds that there is ambiguity in the meaning of a plea of guilty, the canons of statutory construction support interpreting plea of guilty to encompass de facto guilty pleas, first beginning with the legislative intent. In 1949, at the first session of the 81st Congress, a witness explained very clearly the intent of Article 45 Bravo. He said, "The intention is that you do not permit a man in a case in which the death penalty is possible to plead guilty. You just do not let a man plead himself into the death penalty." If appellant were allowed to enter pleas to unpremeditated murder, based on the facts of this case, he would have established premeditation by his pleas alone and would have potentially pled himself into the death penalty in violation of the legislative intent behind Article 45 Bravo. This intent is clear based on the canon of statutory construction of legislative inaction. Courts have interpreted a plea of guilty in Article 45 Bravo to prohibit de facto guilty pleas since McFarland in 1957. And since then, the UCMJ has undergone sea changes, and never has Congress amended Article 45 Bravo in a way to clarify that a plea of guilty is limited to only the formal entry of pleas. In fact, Congress has twice amended Article 45 Bravo and never clarified or changed the meaning of a plea of guilty. From that, we can infer that Congress's intent is that a plea of guilty to de facto pleas of guilty are prohibited by 45 Bravo. Congress has approved of this court's decisions in McFarland and Dock.
Counsel, if I understand the appellant's argument correctly, I think what they're arguing is that there's a lot of emphasis being put on the word de facto there, right? Even in Dock, you can plead guilty to a felony, and you know they did what they didn't allow the appellant there to do is plead guilty to both a felony and a murder, because felony murder would be a capital crime, right? But I think what the appellant's arguing is that would not have been sufficient, right? The government still would have had to have proven that the murder was committed in the commission of the felony for it to be a capital crime that you couldn't plead guilty to. So there were things, there was a burden, maybe slight, but there was still a burden on the government, something the government had to do to prove the capital crime, and that should have distinguished the appellant in Dock wanted to plead guilty to from what Article 45 prohibited. And they're arguing here that what Article 45 prohibits is pleading guilty to a capital crime, not pleading guilty to other crimes that if the government proves a little bit more could be considered a capital crime. So how do we get from Article 45 to all, you know, what we'll call de facto? And I don't know how broadly de facto goes, but how do we get from the text of Article 45 to crimes that if you put them together and add a little more proof from the government, you get a capital crime?
Yes, Your Honor. Whether a judge accepts or rejects a guilty plea is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. So the judge has wide discretion in determining whether the individual's pleas are going to amount to a de facto guilty plea. So in Dock, in the accused opening statement, the defense attorney's opening statement, he did concede a link between the felony and the murder, and that created the de facto guilty plea to felony murder. So I think in that case, that was the key problem, was the pleas in conjunction with the opening statement. In this case, appellant's pleas would arguably be more of a de facto guilty plea than the pleas in Dock, because premeditation is established just in the facts, in the charge sheet, because by pleading guilty to committing these murders and attempted murders in a sequential fashion, just by virtue of the charge sheet, appellant is pleading guilty to targeting 45 individuals with a firearm and killing 13 of them. It is not possible for this to happen in a single moment. Just by virtue of the charge sheet, a fixed purpose to kill deliberately formed is clear. So that relieves the burden from the government of proving premeditation, and the military judge correctly determined that this would be a guilty plea in violation of Article 45 Bravo.
So, counsel, I'm sorry. No, did you have a follow-on question? Thank you. This is actually a follow-on to Judge Hardy's question. And it goes back to your point about the circumstances of this case and the fact that we had 13 deaths. Would Dock still apply if you broke apart those offenses and did 13 court-martials, meaning you have one death, you charge that one death, the accused comes in and wants to plead guilty to unpremeditated murder. And the end of that one, boom, you go to the next one. Would Dock still apply when you had serial court-martials as opposed to having clumped all of the offenses together?
Yes, Your Honor. Based on this case, the judge clearly based her decision on the fact that the murders and attempted murders occurred in sequence, and that's how premeditation would have been established. So in a scenario where there's only one murder or attempted murder per court-martial, then potentially we wouldn't have a Dock issue, but it's very context dependent and dependent on the facts of the case and the specific way that the individual wants to plead. And in this case, appellant did not offer, we're not in that scenario, appellant did not offer to plead to just one murder or one attempted murder. The only offers before the court, which the court properly rejected, included a combination of pleading guilty to unpremeditated attempted murders and unpremeditated murders. I'd also like to address appellant's argument that the legislative intent supports interpreting a plea of guilty to allow the pleading to lesser included offenses. It is true that the legislative history does include a discussion where there is a concern about wanting to allow individuals to plead to lesser included offenses, but it's clear that only when it is not going to establish the elements of the greater offense. The example in the legislative history concerns desertion and AWOL, and the representatives explain that an individual should be permitted, if they desire, to plead guilty to AWOL while contesting that they intended to leave the service permanently. And that distinguishes from what we have here. Appellant showed there's no reason to think that appellant desired to contest premeditation based on the record before the court, and based on the pleas, he would not have been able to do so again because his pleas would prove that he sequentially committed these murders and attempted murders, and that would establish premeditation.
Counsel, that point, that a sequence of shootings would establish premeditation. Is there any legal basis for that assertion, or is that just a matter of logic and common sense?
Your Honor, I would say it's a matter of logic and common sense. And just to reference the manual for court-martial definition of premeditation, it states that premeditation may be inferred from the circumstances. So based on the circumstances of the sequential killings and attempted killings, premeditation can be inferred. I also want to address appellant's argument of constitutional avoidance regarding McCoy. So as Chief Judge Olson recognized in his questioning, McCoy does not create a right to plead guilty. It just recognizes a new category of decision that belongs to the client rather than the attorney. So this is like the decision to testify or the decision to be tried by a judge alone instead of a panel. It doesn't create a new right, just like there's no right to judge alone. There is a right to choose to be tried by a judge alone when that choice is available, but there is simply no right to plead guilty, and so the doctrine of constitutional avoidance is inapplicable here. If this court does find that Dock and McFarland were wrongly decided, that is simply not enough to depart from precedent. In this court, in Andrews, this court recognized that there must be more than just the case law being wrongly decided. Wrongly decided is not enough. This court has said that we will not overturn precedent that has been treated as authoritative for a long time unless the most cogent reasons and inescapable logic require it. The party requesting that we overturn precedent bears a substantial burden of persuasion. Appellant has failed to carry that burden. So first of all, the first factor, other than whether the precedent was wrongly decided, is whether the precedent is unworkable, and it is simply not unworkable. This has been the law for 65 years. Appellant in his brief references a mistrial as possibly being an absurd result. A mistrial is not absurd. That's a thing that can happen in trials, and not necessarily even in the case of an individual who acts in such a way that there is a de facto guilty plea. There are other ways to remedy this, like admonishing the counsel or the individual to not engage in that behavior, sanctions in an extreme situation, or just an instruction to the fact finder to disregard whatever statement or comment had amounted to a de facto guilty plea. So it's not unworkable. So that factor weighs against overturning precedent. Next, there's been no intervening event. As I've already discussed, McCoy was not an intervening event because it did not create a new right. I'd also like to address the fact that Article 45 Bravo has been amended and today only prohibits guilty pleas to mandatory capital offenses. That is also not an intervening event because the language, a plea of guilty, is unchanged. So today, if we were to interpret Article 45 Bravo in line with precedent, it still prohibits de facto guilty pleas to capital offenses that have a mandatory death sentence. The expectations of service members and public confidence also weigh against overturning precedent. Of course, adherence to precedent is the preferred course because it promotes the even-handed, predictable, and consistent development of legal principles, fosters reliance on judicial decisions, and contributes to the actual and perceived integrity of the judicial process. Finally, even if this court finds that the factors weigh in favor of departing from stare decisis, this court in Andrews recognized that there still must be special justification. This court said, even if these factors weigh in favor of overturning long-settled precedent, we still require special justification, not just an argument that the precedent was wrongly decided. It is appellant's burden to present to this court special justification for departing from stare decisis. Appellant has presented no special justification, and in this case, appellant can present no special justification.
Can I ask you a question that's a little bit off the beaten path here? Now, when panel members are deciding whether to impose death penalty, one of the key factors they may consider is whether the accused accepted responsibility for his or her conduct. And it seems as if an accused goes before the panel and says up front, through pleading guilty that I've in fact have committed this crime, then that is a sterile way to indicate that the accused has accepted responsibility. So in an instance like this where an accused is prevented from pleading guilty, should that call into question the legitimacy of the death penalty that was imposed by the panel members?
No, Your Honor, because in this case, the military judge offered an instruction in sentencing, not before the merits, but in the sentencing portion of the trial for the panel to consider that he had desired to plead guilty but was prevented from doing so by operation of law, and that they should consider that in mitigation. And this is on Supplemental JA 1801. You can see the exchange between the military judge and appellant. And six different times he declines the military judge's offer for an instruction in mitigation. So certainly there would have been value to appellant if he had accepted this instruction. But the value of a plea of guilty in sentencing is the mitigation instruction, an instruction from the court to the fact finder to consider that the individual pled guilty as a factor in mitigation in determining the sentence. And so for that reason, there's been no prejudice to appellant, even if this court does decide to depart from precedent. Appellant merits no relief because the military judge offered him this instruction and he declined it. And to respond to appellant's arguments that that was not good enough because the government was able to present evidence on the merits, well, aggravating evidence would be admissible in sentencing regardless, and the government would still prove up premeditation. So all of the evidence that is aggravating would have been admissible in sentencing. A plea of guilty would not prevent the government from presenting aggravating evidence in sentencing.
So just to clarify your point, when the military judge offered the instruction and the accused turned it down repeatedly, are you saying that that demonstrates waiver, or are you saying that demonstrates no prejudice?
I think it's both, Your Honor. He's waived the ability to argue prejudice when he had the opportunity for that mitigation instruction by declining that instruction in mitigation. It's like invited error. He had the opportunity to have the mitigation that he would receive from a plea of guilty, and he declined it. So he merits no relief from this court. If there are no further questions, I can turn to the next assignment of error. The Army Court did not abuse its discretion by denying appellant's motions for recusal. No reasonable person with knowledge of all the facts of General Risch's involvement in this case as SJA would have doubts about the judge's impartiality, especially because General Risch was no longer in the rating chain of the judges when they heard argument and issued their opinion. This court has held that there is a strong presumption that a judge is impartial, and a party seeking to demonstrate bias must overcome a high hurdle. Appellant has failed to overcome this hurdle.
Can you address up front the point that's raised by appellant's counsel in regard to they telegraphed that they really had already come to a decision at the time before the point that then Major General Risch was removed from this case?
Well, I don't agree with that they had telegraphed their decision before the moment that General Risch was removed. But regardless, it doesn't matter. The Army Court did not explain the reasons for not recusing themselves, and that's certainly a factor for this court to consider. But it also seems that the reason they did not do so was perhaps because they believed the issue was mooted by General Risch's removal from the chain. But just because the Army Court did not provide rationale explaining why they found themselves, they found that there was no appearance of impartiality, that factor is not dispositive of whether the Army Court should have recused itself. This court in Mitchell found that the preparation of fitness reports by senior judge advocates for military judges did not create an appearance of impartiality for four main reasons, and those four reasons apply to the instant case and show that the Army Court there was no requirement for recusal. So first, a judge has a sworn duty to dispense justice impartially. Second, fitness reports may not comment on a judge's rulings, and senior judge advocates are expected to follow the law. Third, military judges do have recourse if they feel the pressure of unlawful command influence through things like an Article 138 complaint. And finally, senior judge advocates are not biased in favor of the prosecution or defense. Now, there is a footnote in Mitchell that where the court says their decision may be different on that last point about whether the senior judge advocate is biased in favor of one party, if the reviewing officer had been involved in the case before the court as a trial counsel, defense counsel, military judge, or staff judge advocate. But that footnote does not change things in the instant case. And that's because general
counsel, how so? I mean, then Major General Reich was in fact the staff judge advocate at the time of the offense.
Yes, Your Honor. So the footnote only says that the court's decision might be different. And it's clear, as applied to this case, the decision would not be different because General Risch, by acting as SJA and providing pretrial advice, was not aligned with either the prosecution or the defense like a trial counsel would be or a defense counsel. And also, a military judge, while acting in an impartial position over the court, over the case, a military judge's rulings are often scrutinized on appeal. And in this case, we have no substantive challenge to the content of General Risch's pretrial advice. So because all he did was give independent, objective advice as required, and there's no challenge to the substance of his advice, there's no evidence, a reasonable person would not find that he was aligned in favor of one side to create the appearance of impartiality.
How does that, though, really help your argument? The issue out there then, along the lines of your argument, was still whether then Major General Risch should have disqualified himself, and he failed to do so, regardless of the correctness of the substantive nature of his rulings. So the CCA judges were still in a position where they were being called upon to judge their raiders' legal acumen and perhaps even his ethics in regard to his failure to recuse himself. So how does that benefit the government?
Yes, Your Honor. So I would reference this court's decision in Norfleet, and to quote from that decision, this court said, the fact that the military judge in that case had to rule on the propriety of his superior's actions did not raise an issue so controversial that an adverse decision would have had a significant and lasting direct impact on their professional reputations for competence and integrity. So likewise here, because there's no challenge to the substance of General Risch's pretrial advice, this isn't an issue that's going to have a lasting impact on General Risch's professional reputation. Even appellant acknowledges as much, and this is in Second Supplemental JA-7. Appellant explains that General Risch was allegedly disqualified through no fault of his own. So there's just no risk to General Risch's reputation, even if this court were to decide that he shouldn't have been involved in this case, that would reflect on the Army judge's impartiality. A conflict between military judges' rulings and their personal interests and career prospects arises only in extraordinary circumstances, and we simply don't have those extraordinary circumstances here. So again, to quote from Norfleet, the fact that military judges may issue rulings adverse to the interests of superior officers does not in itself preclude those judges from exercising independence in their judicial rulings. So it's simply not enough that there was a connection between General Risch in this case. And I'd reference Martinez from this court from 1984, 19MJ652. There are two Martinezes that are at issue here. In that case, an appellate judge was previously an SJA who had advised on a congressional inquiry by the appellant who was before him when he was an appellate judge. And the court found that there was no conflict there. So likewise here, just because there's a connection to a case, that's simply not enough to create a conflict that would create an appearance of impartiality. And again, to quote from Norfleet, the legislative history and the structure of the legislation reflect the fact that Congress established the position of the military judge within the context of the military establishment, rather than as a separate entity. So Congress recognized what we say often in the JAG Corps, which is it's a small JAG Corps. We all know each other once we're in the JAG Corps long enough, especially when you get to the higher ranks. It's not unusual for individuals to have prior working relationships or even professional relationships with each other. And just to quote one more time from Norfleet, professional or personal relationships between members of the judiciary and witnesses or other participants in the court-martial process do not necessarily require disqualification. So in this case, the facts of General Risch's involvement are just not extreme enough to create an appearance of impartiality when judges are expected to dispense justice impartially. Raters are expected to not consider the judge's rulings in their evaluation reports. This is simply not the extreme circumstances that would create an appearance of impartiality. And again, because General Risch operated in an objective role when he was providing pretrial advice, so he simply was not aligned with either side, so there's just no bias in favor of one side or the other. So all of the factors that the court in Mitchell considered when it determined that fitness reports for military judges do not create an appearance of impartiality, all of those factors apply with force here.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but can you think of any analogs in the civilian world where you could point to and say the theme would be the same in terms of interconnectedness between parties, maybe of the appellate judges and parties who appear before, and this objective, disinterested observer would not find a reason to question the bias of the judges?
Your Honor, I do struggle to come up with an example in the civilian world, but to somewhat not directly answer your question, I will say that the standard for appearance of impartiality is different in the military, in the military system. The standard is whether the circumstances are so extraordinarily weighty that they overcome the balance struck by Congress. So when Congress created the military justice system and articles under the UCMJ that prohibit raters from commenting on the judge's rulings, Congress considered all of these things and the nature of interactions between officers in the JAG Corps and judges and SJAs when it created its system. So this case is just not so extraordinarily weighty that it overcomes that balance struck by Congress, because General Risch acted as SJA. He provided objective, impartial advice, and there has been no challenge to the substance of his advice. So the Army Court was never put in a decision where they had to judge the propriety of their senior raider. But as this court said in Norfleet, even that is not enough to create an appearance of impartiality. If this court does find that there was an appearance of impartiality and the military and the Army Court should have recused itself, the Liljeburg factors do not require any relief. So first, the risk to appellant is low because General Risch was removed from the rating chain before the Army Court heard argument and issued its opinion in this case.
But they still had heard and decided three motions.
Yes, Your Honor, they did decide motions, but just under the Liljeburg factors, the risk to appellant is still low because the substance of all of the assignments of error that the Army Court considered, the alleged conflict was no longer there at that time. So this, on balance, the risk of injustice to the appellant is low. Additionally, this court is going to review all of the assignments of error that appellant raised before the Army Court without any deference to the Army Court. This court is going to look directly at those assignments of error. So again, this just weighs...
But part of the argument by the defense is that based on some of these decisions that were made, they were precluded from seeing some of the record and really polishing or honing their arguments. And those were decisions that were made at the time by the CCA. So now you're saying, but you, Kath, get to examine these. But their point is, we're only getting one bite of the apple. We should have had a second bite of the apple, beginning with the CCA. How do you respond to that?
While the CCA's breadth of review is broader than this court, appellant has not specified exactly what errors this court cannot review or consider that the Army Court could because of these new materials that appellant has been able to see. So it's just...
But they can cite a different standard of review than the CCA, a broader standard of review than we have.
Yes, Your Honor, but the point I'm trying to make is it's speculative whether any of the new materials that they're now able to see would have fallen under that broader discretion of the CCA and they would have been able to offer relief. But regardless, in terms of this is just one factor under Liljeburg, which is what is the risk of injustice to appellant? And the appellant has only made some speculative references to the broader authority of the CCA. Moving on to the other Liljeburg factors, the risk of injustice to other parties is low because the Army did take action in this case, even though the government never acknowledged and is not acknowledging today that there was a conflict. To moot any concerns, the Judge Advocate General did remove General Risch from the rating chain. So there's not a risk of injustice to future parties because we have this precedent of the Army taking action when there's just a mere allegation of an appearance of impartiality. Finally, there's no risk of undermining public confidence for the same reason. The Army took action and removed General Risch from the rating chain. And I'd reference to the other Martinez. This is from 2011. In that case, the court found that there was an appearance of impartiality, but that the appellant had raised the appearance issue in his post-trial matters, and the convening authority had given some clemency based on the allegation of impartiality. So in that case, the court found that the risk of undermining public confidence was low because the Army, the convening authority, had taken action. So likewise here, the Army took action. The Army removed General Risch from the rating chain. So the risk of undermining public confidence is incredibly low. Pending any questions from the court.
Thank you, Major Sunder. Major Osterhage, please proceed.
And I'd like to start with 45 Bravo. The government is harping on the plain meaning, saying it is a confession. I would ask what exactly his acknowledgement was of the premeditation in the murder. There was no acknowledgement by his pleas of premeditated murder. It's a full stop right there at this point, interpreting the plain meaning as the government has described it. So using that plain meaning, it would seem Doc is quite wrong. The question is, by his pleas alone, could he have been guilty of premeditated murder? No. In fact, the judge says as much at JA 281, where she says, technically, this would, by your pleas, you would not be guilty of premeditated murder. The government points to 65 years of precedent, but that 65 years is two cases, McFarland in the 1950s and Dock in the late 1980s. The government talks about how this is not unworkable. I would ask a judge how it would be possible if guilty pleas are determined by the four corners, and there are no four corners yet in your trial, how you determine whether or not you should be accepting guilty pleas at that stage. You do not know the four corners yet of the record. How do you know? How is that a workable standard for judges to use going forward? Of course, I mean, we recognize that the law has changed, but still, I mean, that is a consideration, how unworkable that is. And the government discussed the, you know, special justification that is needed. It is true, in Andrews, there was the four factors in saying, even if these four factors, he would still need special justification. I would ask this court to look at those cases that it cited, which, if you look at them, they actually say it's more, you need special justification on top of it just being plainly wrong. So I think when you need special justification, it's more than just it being plainly wrong. Those are the four factors in the stare decisis analysis that is the special justification. I'd like to turn to issue number 10. The government, so actually first I'd like to just put a finer point on the significance of this error. So just to put it in context, General Risch was the SJA at the time of the event in 2009, and for all intents and purposes, he was the SJA shepherding this case through up until trial 4 years later. Among every action he took, there are two critical actions. He gave the pretrial advice where he recommended a capital court-martial and capital referral, and he advised on the panel member selection, and he had the excusal authority for those panel members. And to suggest that an accuser, which if there is a personal interest at stake or the reasonable person would impute a personal interest at stake, can do both the recommendation and then assist the convening authority with picking the veneer has great ramifications. So this error is significant. And in fact, the Army Court didn't even discuss the panel selection issue in its opinion. It sidestepped that altogether. And in fact, it came to a conclusion that they didn't have a reason to doubt General Risch's impartiality. And even if he was disqualified, he still gave impartial advice. That was the Army Court's opinion. I don't see how we can't arrive at the conclusion that a reasonable person would question the impartiality where a subordinate is having to review such a significant error in a capital trial. I mean, if this was, Chief Judge Olson, you kind of discussed, is there a civilian analog out there? I would say if those judges were applying to the Risch Law Firm LLC, there would be no question at all that they should be recused. That's their future employment. But now this is their current employment. This is their immediate boss who does their evaluations. This has incredible sway over their positions and their futures. And we're somehow going to say, well, if it was the future employment, we're very concerned, but not this current employment. I don't understand. There's a large disconnect that's happening there if this court comes to that conclusion. And the government did mention there are things insulating judges, and sure enough, there are, but the Mitchell footnote was in recognition of that fact, even though there are statutes and regulations in place to protect judges, even recognizing that fact, this court in Mitchell still dropped that footnote saying there would be a different issue potentially if the rater was, for example, the staff judge advocate. And we have facts greater than Mitchell. We have the significant error against the staff judge advocate, and on top of that, we have a capital case, a high-profile capital case.
Counsel, if I understand the government's position, it's not their position that General Risch didn't play a significant role as SJA. It's that a fully informed observer would be aware that there has never been any challenge on the merits to any of the actions that General Rich took when he was SJA. So I think their position is, given that there's been no assertion of error or bias or mistakes or any real challenge to the actions he took, why wouldn't a fully informed observer think that there's nothing here?
Your Honor, I don't agree with the government's distinction of, oh, it's not his work, so therefore it's okay. It's still, at the end of the day, you're having to decide whether or not your boss committed error such that we would potentially provide relief in a capital case. So that, regardless of...
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. It sounds like then your position is the rule should be it's a per se error when a court has to evaluate when a court has a raider who participated in the proceedings in some manner. Is that essentially your position, or is it your position that should at least be the rule in a capital murder case?
Your Honor, what I would say is that would at least provide grounds for challenge. So I don't know if this court necessarily needs to draw a bright line rule. Certainly we have additional facts other than Mitchell, but I don't know. This court can decide this case solely on the facts presented here without necessarily drawing a bright-line rule, but certainly putting guidance to the field that when you're reviewing the work of your raider, right, there are problems with that. There can be certainly problems with that, as there were here. The government...
just to get back to my point, did the CCA ever really review General Rich's work as an SJA? I mean, were they ever asked to pass judgment on that work, or is it just that he participated?
Well, it was whether or not he was correct in taking the position that he should be on the case, Your Honor. So it was his participation in the case that is at issue. So they are deciding, I mean, it's not necessarily is he correct in his probable cause analysis. It's whether or not he believes he can participate in the case.
Okay, so in your view, then, there is an issue on the merits regarding his judgment. It was his decision not to recuse himself from the case earlier. And the CCA had to pass judgment on that decision, and that's where the problem comes.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Now, the government...
So, counsel, following on, I'm sorry, I know you're almost out of time, but if we accept your position, then what would be the practical effect of that? I mean, what should the CCA have done?
So, Your Honor, we initially when we first filed the recusal motion, we were asking for them to stay or abate the proceedings until General Risch was no longer the raider. So that was an option at that time. And there was a way that they could fix this problem, and they decided not to fix it. The government does cite Norfleet quite extensively here. I would say look at Norfleet. Norfleet was kind of a technical violation, and the boss was actually, the supervisor was actually trying to avoid conflicts in that case. And more importantly, there was a full disclosure of that issue by the judge. There was a full disclaimer of that issue by the judge. So we are very much distinguishable from Norfleet. I just want to point on, I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Any questions from the bench? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. And the court will stand in recess until 11:05.
Stands in recess until 11:05.
Maybe I'm going to get hammered then.
That's 55 is what I mean.
I wasn't counting counsel.
I know. Well, I am. Thank you.